AF.org.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
And I'm Arlene Engelhardt. And you are listening to From a Woman's Point of View. Well, I certainly hope you had a wonderful holiday and that you have a happy new year. I do hope that the next year is better than the one just passing, but we shall see.
Don't we all? And also with us on the phone, one of my favorite guests, and I know you listeners commonly tell us one of yours too, we have the one and only Arnie Arneson, the attitude, the New Hampshire woman, the articulate, cantankerous legal expert that's been involved with helping Harvard International students. So Arnie Arneson, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I refer to myself as a kvetch, but that's okay. Cantankerous, kvetch. I remember I'm a Norwegian Italian who grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. Oh. So that explains that I'm definitely incredibly cosmopolitan.
Okay. Well, anyway, I thought, you know, in this holiday season, I always kind of get a kick out of, and I don't think it makes any difference what your faith is, but I always get a kick out of particularly this Pope's Christmas message. I think this is his fifth Christmas message, and I really thought it was very powerful. When he was talking about the plight of refugees, over 65 million in the world. And he was saying that there's an awful lot of footsteps tracing Mary and Joseph, that are facing just incredibly hard conditions. And the UN had a special kind of little memorial and service for refugees. And I thought this was so powerful. This is 32 refugee women who have actually they've rewritten Silent Night, and when they get into it, I'm going to give you the lyrics because sometimes you might have a little trouble hearing this because I say they've written them over. And so they're going to be singing Silent Night, Painful Night, our mother's tears fall in fright, our loved ones captured and sold, chained and shivering in the cold. Silently, we're praying for peace. Silently, we're praying for peace. And then you meet a few of them again, and then they go back and they say, Silent night, hopeful night, safe and sound, our spirits renewed, lifting our voices for peace, lifting our voices for peace. And so let's hear these 32 refugee women.
Good evening. This is a version of a holiday carol that tells the story of hundreds of thousands of people like us.
You can't see what I've been through, like, just by looking at me. I grew up in the refugee camp. And so when I see those images, I think about how, like my life could have ended.
Back when I used to live in Iraq, I just wonder, like, why it was all ripped away from me.
A refugee, it's not something that I chose to be. I had to start my life from the beginning. A refugee is someone who has courage, and we should cherish that. Many people who have stayed back have died. It still hits me really hard.
I lost so many siblings. They passed away from like basic living conditions. Without the UN, I think my family would still be in that refugee camp.
I guess like when people first come here, they assume that like we're gonna bring terrible stuff. It's kind of a stereotype at this point. If everyone would ever think that, I don't think you've ever met one that like came here with like struggles. One that came here with like a drive to like make sure their kids are safe, to make sure they work hard in this country. And yeah, I don't think they know that.
Lifting our voices for peace. And continuing the Pope in his homily, he said that we need a new social imagination. And Arnie Arneson, I think indeed we do need a new social and political imagination. And I could not think of anyone that I would much rather talk to than you on this date. Didn't you find that a very powerful piece?
I did. And actually, it's so interesting because I did not know that you were going to do this. So I was listening to someone talking on the radio the other day, talking about the fact that Jesus and his family were refugees. So I want to just read you something because I think it's really important. In the second chapter of the Gospel of Matthew, we read the story of the flight into Egypt, in which, after the birth of Jesus and the visit from the Magi, an angel of the Lord comes to Joseph in a dream and warns him to leave Bethlehem for Egypt. Why? Because King Herod was planning to seek out the child to destroy him. Mary and Joseph do leave, along with Jesus, and according to Matthew, make their way into Egypt. Afterward, King Herod slaughters all the male children in Bethlehem under 2 years of age. This dramatic episode is part of the gospel reading for the Feast of the Holy Innocents, celebrated on December 28th. And here's an interesting suggestion for a tweet. A family is forced to flee their homeland for fear of persecution. This is the classic modern-day definition of a refugee.
Yeah, and you know that no room in the inn for Mary and Joseph, but also no room in the world for an awful lot of these refugees.
Yeah. And of course, the date was December 28th. So I'm sure I shared it with you, just so that our timing could be absolutely perfect. You know, we're like bookends. So let me say something that sounds totally nuts. But last night, I'm like laying in bed. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm not sleeping. And something occurred to me, and I want to sort of throw this at you. And I haven't said this out loud to anyone really yet. And I said, remember when Fox News was GOP TV? And then Donald Trump ultimately wins the election, and they morph from GOP TV to Trump TV. Well, they've morphed again, everyone. They're now Russian television. That's what they are. Because when you look at what Putin has been trying to foment, when you look at how he's trying to undermine our democratic institutions, raising suggestions of everything from that coup to whether we should trust the FBI, to whether we should trust... think about everything Putin was doing even during the course of the election and what he's able to do. And then you begin to sort of say, why does Donald Trump never challenge Putin and Russia? And you begin to realize that, you know, I almost feel like it comes from Fox and from whatever the Russians sort of dream about. I mean, they don't even need to infiltrate because they actually have an accomplice. And that accomplice is Fox Television.
Well, you know, Arnie, Kenneth McCallion, I don't know if you're familiar with him. He was a state's attorney for years in New York, and then he got involved with human rights, and he wrote a fabulous book. And I actually had him on the show right before the election, and he has just written the most extraordinary expose, because he has dealt with Trump and Trump's ilk for years. And he was exposing all the contacts they had, you know, because Trump is this brand, and he's this terrible businessman, really, you know, with all these bankruptcies. And then the banks here in this country said, that's it. We're not going to fund you anymore. So they realized that they were going to look so bad if all this came out, the loans they had made to Trump and all of his enterprises, that they put him on a $250,000 a month salary and told him to get his act in order. And so the way back, we're talking the late 80s, that he started, you know, to get any kind of funding. What? You're going to go for laundered money. You're going to go from all of these, you know, these situations, whether it's drugs or it's a lot of the Russian oligarchs that have all kinds of money that they want to launder too. And then with the real estate kind of situation we have here in this country, McCallion was pointed out that actually we have more laundered dirty money in real estate in this country than any other place in the world. And it's not just the Trumps, but it's really objectionable. And so, you know, he was exposing this long before, and he's an avid sailor, and he said if Trump won the election, he was going to sail off to Nova Scotia, but he didn't. And so, yeah, and you know that, you know, Arnie, when you say the transposition of Fox, well, also, you know, kind of the transposition of politics in this country. I mean, I have no idea who the Republicans are now. You know, when I'm looking at a McConnell and a Paul Ryan, you know, and I'm seeing the Koch brothers and I'm seeing the ideology of Buchanan, you know, they are right in your face saying, this is what we're doing. You figure out what we're doing, but we're doing it. And so it stuns me, Arnie.
Well, I there's a couple of things that have happened, and of course this is a slow burn. Donald Trump did not create this. We've been embracing this for a long time. And don't be offended, everyone, but I'm going to sort of begin with 1992 and the fact that we elected someone named Bill Clinton who embraced this concept of the New Democrat. And really what the New Democrat was kind of like, it was like Republican light. The Democratic Party was jealous of the Republican Party because the Republican Party was courting big business and Wall Street and banks, and they were bringing in all this money, and they were sort of being supported. And Bill Clinton suddenly looked and said, wait a minute, why should we cede Wall Street and big business to Republicans? And so rather than ceding it to them, Bill Clinton embraced them. And when he embraced them, what did he forget? He really, to a large extent, forgot the rest of us. Because you can't embrace Wall Street and still work with Main Street. You can't embrace the world of finance and care about unions and workers. You can't, I mean, think about all the things. They're not, they don't work together anymore. Capitalism is so distorted now that whatever the virtue was, it is now morphed into something that basically has created the 1%. And that's really what's happened. And therefore, everything, I mean, if I hear one more time that the only reason why corporations exist is to benefit their stockholders, I'm going to give someone a knuckle sandwich. Because I want to remind everyone, who created corporations? We did. Mm-hmm. We gave them life. We gave them perpetuity. We gave them everything. And if they are a creation of us, then guess what? We can change what they do. And this idea that they should exist for only one reason, which is to benefit their stockholders, well, guess what? That can change, too. Because if we can create them, we can also change that.
Yeah, and we obviously need to. You know, Arnie, I suppose, really, if we're kind of looking at this nation right now, all we have to do is look at, quotes, that tax reform Bible, you might say. Because to me, it's been the wish list that so many of them have been having forever. And being now, you know, it's open door to any lobbyist and anything that you've wanted, you know, your biggest wish, that actually we could kind of see the roadmap that's been happening and will happen, you know, unless we do a lot to stop this.
Well, let's also stop and remember. So we have the morphing of Bill Clinton, who wants to become a Republican because all the virtues of the Republican Party is something he admires. Remember, he was dirt poor. He only earned $32,000 a year, I think, as a governor. They never owned a piece of property. I mean, let's kind of remember, he comes from the other side of the tracks. So to a large extent, Bill Clinton is a lot of like the Trump base. He kind of admires success. He admires the fact that this guy has lots of houses and lots of money. And even when he fails, no one allows him to fail because they scoop him up and put him back up there. So there is this sort of sense here. But then you take that and then you add to that what we've done to sort of become accomplices to that. And that includes everything from Citizens United to gerrymandering to soft money to dark money to all these things that have made it possible for the wealthy who have always been able to get more than everyone else, and that makes total sense. I get it. But now they have so infiltrated the political system that the political system is totally controlled by them, whether it's the number of lobbyists they have, whether it's the amount of money they put in, whether it's the amount of dark money they put in so we don't even know, all the kinds of things that really sort of distort a democracy. So the democracy no longer is serving the people, but it is serving the plutocrats. So you take a look at that, and then take a look at how many millionaires, everyone, are now members of Congress. How many millionaires are members of Congress? They don't want to just be outsiders. They want to play on the inside. Why hire a lobbyist? Why write a check to someone else? Why not just be there to manipulate the system? Because if you understand real estate on the outside, imagine how much better you'll understand real estate on the inside. And that, I think, is so important. There is an article by David Day and everyone. I'm going to tell you to go read it, reread it, share it, and reread it again. The title of the piece at the New Republic is "The Republican Tax Bill is a Gift to the Washington Blob." And what does he mean by the blob? He's talking about all these incredible, incredible wealthy people that actually saw personal financial benefits in that bill. And that bill was designed not only for the wealthy, it was designed for members of Congress. And that's what we know. You know the story of Bob Corker. Why did he switch? Mm-hmm. Nothing changed except for a provision involving a real estate deal that would actually benefit him. You know, and they're now referring to it as the Corker kickback. But what is more important than that is that that's what this whole bill is about. This bill is about people, benefiting in ways we could never have imagined. But this is a bill that benefits members of Congress. And I think we need to hold on to that. You keep thinking that it's the wealthy and it's outside those walls. No, no, no. Everything inside that 128 Beltway, they saw an opportunity here. And even if they lose the election, who the H cares? Because now they just benefited by the tune of millions of dollars for as long as they can imagine. And I think that's the thing that should frighten us, is how self-serving this bill is, not just for the rich, but for so many members of Congress.
Well, you know, you bring up such an important point. Going back to Clinton, you know, ending welfare as we know it. And I guess he thought by courting, you know, Wall Street and by ending welfare as we know it, somehow he would take away all the tools of the Republican Party. And I don't know whether he was surprised when they said, okay, fine, you can do it. Now we'll go on to other things. And I guess my point is, and you've just made it very well, that, you know, once you get a certain stage of money, frankly, you know, it becomes numbers, and it's all about power, and that becomes far more addictive, I think, than even the sum of money.
Well, but they get it all. They get power and they get money. So here's the thing: even if they leave the Senate or they leave Congress, how many former members of the Senate and Congress are now lobbying their friends in Washington? Over 400 of them. It's a revolving door. Part of the benefit of this tax reform bill and what it gave to corporate America by reducing their corporate taxes from 35% to 21% without stopping any of the loopholes. Remember this. They didn't cut out any of the loopholes. They just lowered the damn tax. And for the most part, 35% was paid by nobody. The average corporate tax in America was 21% because of all the loopholes. And now we've given them 21% and they still have the loopholes. We'll be writing checks to corporate America. We won't be getting revenue. We'll be owing them money. And the beauty of that is that when you leave Washington, even if you damn lose, guess who scoops you up? The guys that you just paid all that money to and gifted them all that money, because you're guaranteed to be hired by them. In a lot of ways, they were paying it forward, and they were paying it forward for them. So if they weren't a millionaire, they knew where the next job was coming from, because those guys owed them big time, because this was a corporate wet dream. They never imagined 21%. Not only 21%, but none of the loopholes being closed. Oh, my God. This is beyond a gift.
I'm glad that you said it. I've always wanted to say it was a corporate wet dream, because
it is.
It totally is.
What it is. Come on. Don't be nice anymore, because they weren't nice.
No.
They shafted us. They blew up the deficit. They don't care about how they're going to pay for infrastructure. They're going to shred every safety net program. Why? so rich people can buy another yacht, another island, you know, create another walled-in city? I mean, they're not going to create jobs, except for maybe some jobs mowing their lawn.
Yeah, and I was thinking of Louis Brandeis, and I'm sure he wasn't the only one, but saying we have a choice. You can have a democracy or you can have great wealth. You can't have both.
Yeah.
And also, I'm also thinking, because I'm really concerned, because more and more they're changing the rules of the game. And so it becomes harder and harder when a different administration gets in. And as you've just pointed out, there's not nearly the difference you would like to see, because power utterly corrupts and it's tantalizing to everybody that seems to get exposed to it. But they're changing the rules in such fundamental ways. And, you know, I guess, Arnie, one of the things that bothers me the most, you know, that I think, frankly, you know, whether it's those refugees, particularly the young ones with their passion, their imagination, their intelligence, their work ethic, to me, the future of this country always depends on its youth. It depends on the young. And it depends on that education. And I am watching what we have done to, you know, higher education, making it, it is so scandalous that it's the debt now involved with you know, college and university fees is more than the credit card debt, and it's only a very close second to mortgage debt in this country. And to me, that's also changing the rules of the game. And so you're really going to deny, except to your children and like children, the opportunities for the education you need to succeed.
So let's start calling it what it is. This is what student debt is, everyone. Start using this new word. It's the anti-dowry. It's the anti-dowry. How do you start a life? How do you build a family? How do you buy a house? How do you plan for the future? How do you be entrepreneurial and create new jobs and run risks when you are overly, overly overwhelmed with $400, $500, $600, $700 worth of debt? And that's before you rent a place. That's before you buy a car. That's before you pay for your health care. Think about this. It is immoral. It is immoral. And on top of that, even the new tax reform plan screws graduate students. I mean, talk about insult to injury. So they hurt graduate students in the tax reform plan and literally harm them as I left before. This is one of my tweets from yesterday. I wrote, I can finally sleep. Just learn new tax law not only slashed corporate tax rate to 21%, but let's tax intact deductions for the use of corporate jets, traveling salesmen's bar tabs, and cost of executive retreats. You know, golf clubs such as those owned by Donald Trump. I mean, think about this. What can we do to students? We actually harmed students in the tax reform plan. We didn't recognize the failure. We didn't understand what kind of indentured servants they are. But this tax reform plan is basically almost, it's like people have targets on their backs. Whether you're in Puerto Rico and they hurt Puerto Rico, whether you're in New York or New Jersey or Washington, D.C., or any state that has a corporate tax and a income tax and a sales tax and a property tax, they literally harm them by limiting the amount of deduction to $10,000. They went out of their way to hurt. So not only did they aid and abet corporations and the rich, but they actually used it as target practice.
Ooh. And again, we are talking to Arnie Arneson. She is an extraordinary political analyst, as you can see. And luckily, she has a daily radio program. And so, Arnie, I'm just going to take a brief musical interlude. So, because you've said so much in this last few minutes, that I'm going to give. No, that is fabulous. That's why I wanted you on. We're just going to play this little bit, and then we will come back. And again, as I said, we are with Arnie Arneson. the late Laura Nero definitely is saving the country. But we definitely have the woman with us on the show that will give us all kinds of ideas how to save this country, because Arnie Arneson has been fighting for the best in this country, I think, her entire life. And so, Arnie, you mentioned Puerto Rico. And, you know, to me, Puerto Rico represents so much of the kind of financial boondoggle we have put up with. You know, that there, whether it was Detroit and looking at Flint, but with Puerto Rico, they're shackled with all this debt. And so really, to repair Puerto Rico, they have to figure out, number one, who owns what and who's going to collect the debt, so to speak. And don't you see that as kind of way too illustrative of what's been happening financially in this country in so many areas?
But there's no question about it. But then understand that in the tax reform plan, they treat Puerto Rico as a foreign national.
Yes.
And they put an additional surtax on money that's coming out of, corporate whatever. But, I mean, they added a surtax on Puerto Rico. They treated it like it was a foreign country. It is part of us. It is part of us. I mean, the problem with this administration is that they are obsessed with the cost of everything and the value of nothing. They're completely obsessed with that, as if that is the only way that you sort of evaluate everything. And they look at Puerto Rico as a cost. They don't see anything of value. And that's why the governor of Puerto Rico basically said he was going to let the word out to every... I mean, when he saw the tax reform plan, he was out of his mind. He was out of his mind. I mean, it's one thing not to have electricity. It's one thing to be like 100% devastated. It's one thing to wait for enough people to come from FEMA and HUD to help them. They don't understand it, but they can tolerate it. But then to do this, what was the point? What was the point except to harm them? You know, except to make it impossible for them to rebuild, for making it impossible for them to survive. And you heard that the governor of Puerto Rico said he was going to, like, send the word out to every Puerto Rican all over the country that they need to actually use their vote and be strategic. And someone said, but Puerto Rico's a little island. And I reminded everyone, I was born in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, everyone, okay? Now, that I'm 64 years old, so put this into perspective. But where I was born in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, there were more Norwegians than in Oslo, Norway. Okay, so when you hear, but Puerto Rico's a little island, there are a lot of people that are going to claim Puerto Rican heritage. There are a lot of people that married into Puerto Rican families. The politics of Florida is going to be changed forever.
Oh, I couldn't agree more.
I love it. I'm so out of it on the island. So I am glad that governor said that, and I'm like, I'll become a Puerto Rican. I mean, I'm ready.
Yeah, but you know so much about this. Number one, just the unbelievable cruelty, you know, that, you know, the death rate. You know, they keep trying to obscure the death rate, and I really would like to know what the death rate is, you know, without the electricity, without the potable water, without the sewage, et cetera.
Right.
And this is just diabolically cruel. I mean, it's just the abuse of power. And this is what I find that is so disgusting, you know, this abuse of power because they have it and they can get by with it, and they are. And again, I'm going back to Detroit, you know, that essentially they pulled the same nonsense on Detroit, and then with Flint, and you and I know, Arnie, that there are all kinds of, you know, infrastructure problems throughout this country where we're getting contaminants in water. We have like 9 bridges a day that are failing, and, you know, engineers are warning us that we need a serious infrastructure rebuild. And do you wonder what kind of plans they are going to have for our infrastructure rebuild?
So let me stop you here, because we got to talk about infrastructure in a very different way. So be prepared, everyone, because I'm not going to put my hand out saying, fixing my bridge, fixing my highway, fix whatever it is. And that is, let's look at 2017. 2017 was the most acute weather year ever. Let me repeat this. I'm not going to call it climate change, but I will call it acute weather. The most acute weather ever. Whether we're looking at the snowfall in Erie, Pennsylvania just recently, whether we're looking at now the largest fires ever in California, whether we're looking at what happened as a result of Harvey with 15% more water than they've ever seen before, it is unbelievable. They did a calculus of the acute weather, and it hit everywhere in the country. Almost nobody escaped these acute situations. Now, if you have that in 2017, what do you think 2018 is going to look like? Is it going to go back to the good old days? There are no such thing as the good old days. Past does not tell us what the present and the future is going to look like. So if we are talking about infrastructure, we cannot rebuild, we have to anticipate. Because if we don't anticipate the kind of challenges that we are now, I mean, it's telling us. It told us in 2017, pay attention, everyone, then we are destined to not only fail and fail gloriously and piss away billions and trillions of dollars in whatever rebuild we do, but we are going to face another refugee crisis. You began with your song about refugees, so I'm going to talk about another kind of refugee, the climate refugee. And I don't mean the climate refugee from Syria or the climate refugee from Latin America or from Haiti. I'm referring to the climate refugee from California, from Houston, from Florida. We are going to see climate refugees because they can't go home. Not only do they not have the infrastructure, but they don't have the money to rebuild their house because their house is the only asset they have. And when they are totally devastated and everyone is afraid that there will be another fire the next year, who is going to make that investment? Who is going to buy that piece of property? What do you do? And if we don't look at infrastructure, not as a rebuild and a repair, but as an anticipation of the challenges of the future, we have murdered people.
Yeah, I have people that I've been following, excuse me, Ernie, in California. And first, the Northern California fires. And, you know, that literally people, you know, the winds would change and they were getting these fierce winds. And literally, they would have police coming down or officials saying at 3 o'clock in the morning, get out. You've got to immediately get out. Get out now. And literally, they were taking their four-wheel vehicles and cutting through woods to escape these fires. Well, then when they finally got them under control, when they went back, they found, you know, nothing but ash. But not only was it ash, we're talking toxic ash.
But
I'm also following Pruitt, and I'm following the Secretary of Interior and his little buddy deputy James Kasin. And, you know, like with the Arctic National Refuge, there they want to, you know, allow you know, fracking, oil drilling, etc. And hey, the oil companies, the fossil fuel peoples are going to pay $100 million a year because their whole plan for all of our natural resources in this country, which we're sitting on absolute fossil fuel gold, is that they're going to pay for themselves, all of our beautiful lands are going to become profit adventures, and this is going to take care of some of our debt. Now, this is the thinking of these people, which is so extraordinarily, to me, diabolical.
So this has been the year of deregulation. This has been, Trump has been wildly successful. He's been wildly successful not only changing our concept of what is a democracy, not only being sort of, you know, changing anything that represented a norm, but between what he has done to the regulatory environment and what he has done. I mean, the beauty of this is that they think that they're wildly successful because they're going to, like, you know, soften these regulations or the SEC is not going to enforce, and all those things have potential downsides. But let me just say something about oil, coal, and gas. The world is moving away from that. Let me repeat that. The world is moving away from that. Despite what Pruitt is doing, despite what Donald Trump wants to do, despite the drilling, what we are seeing is that is yesterday's energy story. It is not today's and tomorrow's. And if we want to be successful on a world stage, and if we don't want to be a toxic waste dump, then guess what? If you're a corporation, if you're an insurance company, if you're a homeowner, if you're a business, you are not going to be excited about the cost of oil. You're going to start looking at, what does it cost me to have my solar panels? How can I put geothermal in my, you know, in my backyard? What do I need to do for conservation? What can I do to attach myself to wind? Because what you get from that is you get competition, you get reduction in cost, and you get where the world is going. I know Donald Trump wants to go back to 1950. Here's the good news. Nobody else is.
Yeah, I'm thinking of France, you know, because the EPA is just kind of like the State Department. They're just shutting it down. And some of our best climate scientists, you know, are literally taking positions in France because they can keep their working, you know, going.
And so invited them.
We've got a brain drain.
You, not a problem. Do your science here. I mean, it's. I understand what Trump wants to do, but he's not going to be able to do it. And I think I've said this to you before. Never in my life did I ever think I'd be grateful for the insurance industry. But I am, for one reason. The insurance industry understands climate change. The insurance industry looks at risk. The insurance industry prices for climate change and for risk. And if you think that you're going to be able to get insurance on a house in Houston, after you've been flooded out three times, you're smoking something. I'm just telling you right now, it ain't going to happen. And if you think, I mean, I'm just telling you right now, and that's the beauty of all this. And on top of which, you need to start covering what's been going on in Harris County and in Houston after Harvey. Because, you know, just because it's out of sight doesn't mean it's out of mind. And what I think is really the sort of untold story about that is that there are so many houses in that area in the last 5 years that have been flooded not once, not twice, but three times. And technically what happens is FEMA and HUD come in when you've had that kind of, you know, consistent flooding. They say, we'll buy out your house. We don't want to rebuild. We don't want to spend the money. We want to do this. But there are so many of them now, and there is so little money and so few people being put back into FEMA and HUD that the thousands of homes that should be literally eradicated and get bought by the feds, it isn't happening. So they have no incentive to rebuild. They have no money to rebuild. The only asset they have has no value. And the federal government understood that and actually set up a program based on the number of times you've had this consistent flooding to actually say that we're going to stop this and we're going to not hemorrhage. But guess what? Instead of sending trillions of dollars to corporations and to wealthy people, why didn't we put money into this, which would have benefited so many people in these absolutely awful Sophie Choice situation.
Well, and again, we're talking to Arnie Arneson. Don't you wish you were in New Hampshire so you could hear her public radio program every day? And Arlene says that we have a couple questions that people have emailed in. Do you want to ask those, Arlene?
We do. One is, why do we accept decades of more than $3 billion per year of aid to a foreign country, Israel, when we aren't taking care of American citizens in Puerto Rico?
Well, the aid to Israel is like the aid to Egypt. It's like the aid to Saudi Arabia. It's all about weapons. So can I just say something? That is what this is all about. And the argument for the aid to Israel and the argument for the aid to Saudi Arabia, and the argument is it's about jobs. It's about jobs. Build another bomb. Just amazing. And then on top of that, what did Israel do when Donald Trump decided to move the capital to Jerusalem? You know, something that has everybody in the world apoplectic. Did you just see that they're renaming sites in Jerusalem after Donald Trump?
Yes. I think they're
naming a railroad station. Here's the irony. I want to send the Israelis the list of all the buildings in New York City that are taking the Trump name off of them. they are removing the Trump from the Trump Hotel and the Trump this. They are removing the Trump name because it's toxic, because it's misogynist, because it's racist, because it lies, because it's everything. And what is Israel doing? They're putting his name in the, I believe it's in the old part of the old city, which is where this this railroad station is. I'm like, what are you, nuts? You know, so it isn't just that we are sending them money. We are now basically aiding their inability to ever find some sort of solution for the Israeli-Palestinian issue. We are feeding their worst angels. We are feeding their worst angels. And because you asked me that question, can I just say something? I'm going to be doing C-SPAN on Monday morning, New Year's Day. I'm on Washington Journal. And I'm going to tell you what I want to do, and don't think I'm crazy. But one of the questions they asked me was, like, what do I want to tell Washington? What's my message to Washington? And I have a lot of messages, trust me. But I want something hopeful. I want something that begins the repair. And I don't know if you are familiar with this movie from 2007, but there was a movie called The Band's Visit, and it was made by an Israeli, and it is one of the most beautiful.
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay? It's amazing. So let me just share with you. I woke up at 4 in the morning a couple of weeks ago, and I couldn't sleep, and I turned it on, and I saw this film as I was channel surfing, and for whatever reason, I stopped. And I could not stop watching it. It is just beautiful. It is the best political statement at a time we need this. It's about an Egyptian police band that is coming to Israel to open some event at some, like, Muslim, I don't know what, and they get lost in the desert. And they're in this little town in the Negev desert. And it is just beautiful because it's about Egyptians and Israelis. Yes, it's about Muslims and Jews. Yes, it's about everything that should feel uncomfortable and miserable. But this film is about our common humanity. It is beautiful. And guess what? I finished watching the film, And I Google it to find out more about it. It just hit Broadway. They made it into a musical to rave, remarkable reviews. Because more than ever, we need to understand our common humanity. And of all places to tell it, they're telling it in this story about this, these Egyptians and these Israelis. And I want every member of Congress to go and see the band's visit that just hit Broadway to remember it's not about walls. It's not about division. It's not about the other. It's about what is who we are, the essence of our humanity. And the band's visit tells that story. It never mentions politics, but it's one of the most political films I've ever seen.
You know, Arnie, I think it's so interesting that you say that. Because, you know, I have felt actually for a long time that if Israel and the Palestinians couldn't somehow work out and understand each other, you know, after all the history that both of those people have been through for thousands of years,
right.
I thought it has to start there. And I think, you know, I think of all the Crusades, and I think of the Muslims, and I think of the Arabs, and I think of the Christians, etc. And to me, I think that's maybe what's so lacking, and I think that's why I so love to have you on the show, because you, anyone that listens to you, you are a human being, and you think, and you're going to have your reaction to that. And that seems to be what really is missing, certainly in our country today, that people, you know, our government really representing and caring about people, so people can actually do their things and come out with their marvelously creative and eccentric things that actually really makes a strong country.
Exactly, and look, the hardest thing to do is to do the right thing. It's not easy, everyone. It isn't easy, but that's something, that's part of, you know, we keep talking about bringing civics back into the classroom. Part of what civics is the idea of understanding what is the right thing to do. A democracy cannot function without a participatory electorate. They can't. We can't cede it to someone else. We can't let someone take care of us. We need to appreciate it. So in a lot of ways, I need to thank Donald Trump, because Donald Trump has taught America a really remarkable civics lesson. Not those that watch Russian TV, and I'm referring to Fox, because Fox is basically about lies. Just like Donald Trump is about lies, just like Roy Moore is about lies. I mean, the fact that Roy Moore is asking for another election and undermining what happened, you know why Roy Moore is doing this. Because, you know why? Because that election in Alabama was about blacks finding their vote.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, if blacks are voting, it must be an illegal election. That's what this is about. Let's read between the lines, everyone. Why would anyone think this is illegal when over 20,000 votes ended up putting Doug Jones, who's probably going to become a U.S. senator today, he will be, the election will be recognized today, understand that Roy Moore is pulling a Donald Trump. He has to challenge what we see. Don't believe your eyes. Don't believe the numbers. Trust me. I know there was something evil happening here. There was fraud happening here, and that's what he's doing. And the way he's doing it, the fraud that Roy Moore is talking about, is code for black.
Yeah, and you hear the voices of those four little girls in that Birmingham church.
Yes.
You know, because you can't dismiss that from Doug Jones. And so you also think of Martin Luther King, you know, the arc of justice bends slowly. But you know, Arnie, that is what it's about. It's people believing in the decency of themselves, you know, following that inner light, particularly the light of this time, and actually believing in it and realizing that has to be the beliefs that go into the making of a democracy.
And I, again, I'm going to ask the question, and I keep asking this question, what is an economy for? Is it only for the 1%? No. No, that's not what an economy is for. We all live here. We all participate. We all are the worker bees. This is about the gestalt. It's about the whole. It is not about aiding and abetting the 1%. And you've heard me ask this question, and I will ask this question again and again, because someday I'm going to sit across from Hillary Clinton. I'm going to find a way to do it. We know each other. She knows who I am. And I'm going to ask the question, so Hillary, when are you rich enough? And if Hillary Clinton, that is the question about that time between leaving the State Department and 15 months later announcing she's running for president, and she personally raised, by giving speeches of $400,000 and $500,000, $21 million. And at the time she left state, she and Bill were the richest ex-presidents. And if Hillary Clinton had been asked that question, it would have been a come-to-Jesus moment, because that is important. Because if she can't answer the question, then why do you expect Donald Trump not to be able to?
Yeah, they're never rich enough. There's never enough money. Then it becomes totally about power. And that's perfect for them, because it never ends. It's always expanding. You know, you got to try to somehow be that number one, and you're better than all those number twos. And then you can look back and keep hammering on them. And so it's not a good way for a nation or a country to grow. And I know Arlene wants to get the other question in.
Yes, please. I'm sorry.
It's okay. No, this has been very interesting. But another question from a listener, and it's a bit of a change of subject. How do we feel offended by Russians meddling in U.S. elections when our country has for decades and continues today to take out the heads of state and change governments throughout the world?
Donald Trump was right when he said that. Donald Trump said that, you know. He said that as well. He said, who are we to talk about Russians messing in our elections when we have literally done exactly the same thing? And I am not disagreeing with that. And I think here's the problem. We are never honest with the American people. We have not told them that. They don't know that toxicity is part of their history. We whitewash history. We literally whitewash history. We need to insist upon a history class for everyone to talk about all our mistakes, all our failures, all our flaws, what we've done in everywhere, in every country practically in the world, especially in South America and Latin America, and many places in the Middle East, where we created the coup, where we basically aided and abetted. You know, we saw a democratic result we didn't like, so we wanted to change it. I mean, understand that has been our history. But do you think we've actually taught that? Do you think we know that? So in a bizarre way, you know how a stop clock is right twice a day? Well, that's when Donald Trump actually told you the truth. Okay? He really did. And the other time Donald Trump told you the truth was over Christmas, when he was at his resort at Mar-a-Lago and walked into a bunch of his friends and said to them, you like me, you love me, I just made you richer.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
So I just want you to know, he does tell you the truth. It doesn't happen very often. Make sure you grab it when it does. But these are two times that it does. And one is acknowledging our failure to cover his proverbial butt. And the other is to acknowledge what we all know. This was a gift to his rich friend.
You know, Arnie, I'm thinking of my Midwestern roots. And we always believe that you got to be real careful. You don't ever believe your press clippings. And I guess I'm thinking about Archie Bunker and standing there singing, God bless America. And I suppose if you really think that we were destined by God to be the absolute pillar of democracy and freedom and people, you could fall for a lot of stuff.
But I'm, how do I say this? I've said this before. I want every candidate for office to file two statements. One statement is their personal financial statement, something Donald Trump never did. And the other one is their personal failure statement. And I have, someday I'll write the book of all my mistakes. And they're pretty horrific, some of them, everyone. And there are times I've actually told the stories of some of the terrible things I've done in a public setting, just to let people know I'm not a saint. I'm not that good. But I learned from my mistakes, because I was willing to at least acknowledge them. And if you can't acknowledge them, then you can't make change. And the reason why I want America to understand its mistakes, its failures, its flaws, who they hurt, how they manipulated elections in other countries, is that if they absolutely understand we have done it too, then maybe we have the ability to say, but we don't have to do it again. But if you don't tell us, then how do you fix it?
Well, Arnie Arneson, I hope actually you write a lot of books. I don't know how you can stretch a 24-hour day into 28 or 30 hours. I think that's what you'd have to do to get all that stuff in. But I really want to thank you for all the time, just who you are, Arnie, your courage, your ability to really analyze things, but your very definite human response to this world. And is there anything you wanted to say that because we've gone into a lot of areas, but I didn't want to cut you off without if you want to have say.
So when I ran for governor, I had on all my stationery the following things, because we talked about money and power. And I want power too, okay? But I want power based on ideas. I don't want power based on money. That's a toxic coercion, that money power. But I had on my stationery that political candidates have a choice. They can pander to people's fears in an effort to win, or they can speak the truth in order to lead. I want to find those truth tellers, and I want power and leadership with them, not because someone can write a check, but because someone can actually speak the truth and hold people's hands and say, let's do this together.
Well, Arnie, those are very wise words that we really need right now. And you just keep up. You just keep up your great work, lady.
I'm exhausted, but it's okay.
Anyway, thank you so much. And listen,
Happy New Year.
And I will look forward to seeing you again. You're on C-SPAN January 1st.
720 right? Washington Journal, Monday morning.
Okay, Arnie Arneson, thank you so much. And you just keep going, girl.
All right, ciao. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, the one and only Arnie Arneson. Arlene, did you want to say something?
Well, I just wanted to say thank you to Michael Donahue of Boulder, Colorado, for a very generous contribution to the station this morning.
Sweet.
So,
thank you.
We really appreciate that, Michael, on behalf of everyone here at the station.
Well, I just, you know, after Arnie, what can you say? I guess I'm going to put on one of my favorites, actually, Patti Smith. And I think it's really important that we do remember that we do have the power. And you have been listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. This has been From a Woman's Point of View. And Arnie Arneson is a treasure. And she speaks, I think she tells it like it is. And so does Patti Smith. Oh, nope, sorry about that. That's not the one I want, but I'm hoping this one is.
Wouldn't the armies cease advancing? Because the people.